We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right.
No Maria once again this week. She's lying in bed depressed because it was that kind of week. No, she should be back next week.
Keeping her fingers crossed.
Yeah, very much so.
But we still have plenty to cover.
Oh, yeah. So, hang in there. It was like the all-time depressing week for news, but there are a couple good items that we'll get to, too.
We have hidden within.
Yes, exactly.
All right. So
sort of like Easter eggs.
Let's start out with developments with the South Lake Union.
Yeah. Starting out with the local, the City Council's South Lake Union Committee met on Monday. And as we talked about quite a bit last month, when they upzoned all of the holdings of Paul Allen and the other very wealthy developers who are taking advantage of the city investments in South Lake Union, they upzoned that last month. The City Council was in such a rush to do so that they didn't decide on a lot of the details. And one of those details is how much money developers would need to set aside, or how much of their properties they would need to set aside to develop so-called affordable housing to replace the affordable housing stock that they're tearing down to make room for these projects. And this is something called the incentive zoning program, where developers can either set aside a certain number of their units for affordable housing, and by that they're talking 80 to 100% of annual median income. So it can be up to $64,000 in income for a family of four, which is for not that poor, really, but it's certainly better than the market rate housing that is being sold in places like South Lake Union. Anyway, they need to decide what the rates were. Developers currently can pay something called an in-lieu-of fee into a city fund that creates affordable housing rather than building the units themselves on site. And the rates that the city set when they set up that program were so low that every developer is choosing to do that, and it doesn't build nearly as much affordable housing as is being torn down. So there were four proposals before the South Lake Union Committee, which is comprised of all of the city council members, all nine. One from Nick Licata that raised the rates considerably so that it actually would pay for as much affordable housing as is being lost, and also expanded the definition of who would be eligible so that poorer people down to 60% of average median income would be eligible. That proposal got no traction whatsoever. No other council members spoke in front of it. Instead, there were three other proposals, one from Michael Bryan, and then one from Sally Clark, and one from Tim Burgess, that more or less kept the status quo. They made some adjustments to inflation, but did not adjust the basic framework, which is an enormous amount of indirect corporate welfare for developers. It looks like the Clark and Burgess proposals have been combined under heavy lobbying pressure from wealthy developers, and the combined proposal is actually worse than either of them individually were. Michael Bryan's proposal, which does make adjustment for inflation, so it's an incremental improvement, but not nearly of the scope that is needed, appears to be the one that has the most support at this point, but because of the heavy lobbying pressure, probably they didn't actually make a decision last week. They're going to make the decision instead next Monday in 2 days at another meeting of the South Lake Union Committee in City Council chambers at 2 o'clock. So now would be a fine time to contact your city council representatives, to the extent they represent any of us, and ask them to do what they can to make sure that the final proposal, whatever it is for South Lake Union, includes as much funding for affordable housing as possible, because this is really the largest rezone that Seattle has in the pipeline coming for the next number of years, and it sets a precedent for all the others, because for all these projects, these rates are set individually. If the rate that's set for developers to pay for affordable housing on this particular project is still not nearly what it should be to replace what is being lost, that's a precedent that is likely to carry going forward, at least for the next several years.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with the massive explosion in Texas.
Yeah, there was an enormous act of terrorism on U.S. soil that killed dozens of people this week. Not referring to Boston, referring to Texas, where the explosion at a fertilizer plant in the town of West Texas near Waco was so massive, it showed up as a 2.1 Richter scale earthquake in Denver. That's 900 miles away. It shows you how big that blast was. It flattened a lot of the town. And it really is a testimony. It was an act of terrorism at a number of levels. It was entirely preventable, and it wasn't prevented because of political ideology, because the predictable consequences of that ideology, which is no regulation whatsoever, no enforcement of the regulations and laws that actually are on the books. And, you know, you throw in a fair amount of ignorance along with that, and you get a catastrophe. It does make me wonder in terms of the rugged individualism and evils of federal government and all that we hear from Texas. And we heard from Governor Rick Perry when he turned down Obamacare Medicaid expansion because he doesn't like handouts. It does make me wonder if they're turning down the disaster aid for the consequences of the explosion. I kind of doubt it somehow. The problems with the fertilizer plant in West are legion, and you know we have a busy week, so I won't go into all of them. Once again, we have these stories linked on the website at www.eatthestate.org, and you can follow the links and get all the details. But we have no zoning whatsoever in West, as in a number of other towns and cities in Texas, including ones as large as Houston. So that you had this extremely explosive plant literally more or less next door to both a nursing home and a local school, both of which were completely destroyed in the explosion. So you have it in a neighborhood where it's not really designed. The regulatory history of the plant is really a bad joke. They told state and federal regulators that there was no risk that the enormous tanks of ammonia in the plant, which were many times more ammonia than were used in the Oklahoma City bombing, that they had no risk at all of exploding. You had air permits not even being required by the state until 2004. OSHA hadn't visited the facility since 1985. At that time, the then owner got a $30 fine for a serious violation of storage of anhydrous ammonia. That's a direct quote. The EPA's last risk assessment was in 2006, and it goes on and on and on. And then you had local firefighters when a fire broke out at the plant, trying to put out the fire with water, which you can't really do with ammonia because it goes boom. It really was, because so much of this was fairly predictable, that this was a much higher risk situation than anyone was acknowledging, and nobody was really paying attention to it. And the company, for its part, it's much easier to pay and cheaper to pay the occasional fines than to actually make the improvements that are necessary. It's a cost of doing business. It is an act of terrorism, because you know sooner or later at some of these facilities bad things are going to happen. And at this one, the scale just happened to be spectacular, so we noticed it. But we never frame it that way when it's corporate malfeasance. We never frame it as terrorism. And we do frame things like Boston as terrorism when that, too, is just the cost of doing business. In that case, the way we conduct business all around the world. So they're very similar kinds of incidents, but the one in Texas affected more people or at least directly affected more people and cost more lives.
All right. And then on to Boston.
Yeah. There's not a whole lot to add except to say that once again, as often happens in this case, the media coverage, at least they didn't show the more gruesome scenes of people who were injured in the attack with amputated limbs and so forth. But that was about all they got right. There was a lot of immediate speculation about Al-Qaeda connections and international terrorism and such, even though at the time, for much of the week, we had no idea even who the suspects were, much less what the motives were. And almost all of the evidence in the case pointed toward it being some sort of a homemade bomb and amateur bombers, which is not the mark of an international terrorist group generally. It's much more the mark of people acting individually, like the guy who tried to bomb the MLK Day parade in Spokane a couple of years ago, or for that matter, Oklahoma City. But you had that. Once we did find out how who the suspects were, the couple of Chechen brothers, and they're at this point the lead suspects, but we still don't necessarily know a lot of the details. We don't know if they were acting alone. We don't know for sure what their motivations were. But the speculation is enormous and really, really not called for in a case like this. But, you know, at the same time, you had a lot of media figures, particularly on the right, but also mainstream ones, you know, giving a lot of speculation about international terrorism and who we should bomb in retaliation. There were a number of tweets when the suspects were named yesterday, particularly from the right wing, saying, well, we should go and bomb the Czech Republic because of this. Well, Chechnya is not the Czech Republic. They're 1,500 miles apart and totally whatever. You also had Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina announcing that the suspect should be held as an enemy combatant without trial, which may well happen given Obama's civil liberties record. But this was a crime, and it should be tried as a crime in American courts under American law, which handles such incidents just fine and has done so for most of our history, at least up until bedwetting politicians got involved in the last decade or so. You also had Tony Perkins, the Christianist head of the Family Research Council, coming out and blaming the Boston bombings this week. And this, again, is a quote on abortion, family breakdown, sexual liberalism, and religious hostility. Well, maybe the religious hostility. We don't know that. But, you know, people like Perkins have just as much or more religious hostility. And it really, you know, for all of the heroism and courage displayed by a lot of the onlookers and witnesses at the site of the Boston bombing, it really did bring out a lot of the ugly in American culture and in media coverage this week. And that was very discouraging. Oh, and there was another act of terrorism this week also. Some dim-witted anti-government nut job in Mississippi sending ricin to Senator Roger Wicker, Republican senator from Mississippi. The senator, I don't know, he was upset because his business failed or some sort of nonsense like that. But, you know, there weren't a whole lot of cameras trained on the finish line of the Capitol mailroom, and you know, he's not a Muslim immigrant, so it didn't make nearly the news. You know, just in general, and we had a bunch of developments that I'll get to in a second on gun laws this week also, and there are more people killed in gun violence about every hour in this country, than were killed in Boston this week. But, again, this gets so much attention, and now is a time to be extremely vigilant for demagoguing politicians, particularly in Congress and in the White House, to be pushing through yet more civil liberty curtailing legislation. We had the Patriot Act right on the heels of 9/11. We've had a number of things since then. And what a number of people are likely to advocate, and we'll talk about this when we get to CISPA, the new cybersecurity bill, in a little bit. You know, this is going to be used to push a lot of things that take away freedom in the name of preserving freedom. And we really need to do everything we can not to let this incident fuel that narrative.
All right. So while the TVs and news were focused on all that, the House, the Senate, passed, or didn't in this case pass.
Yeah, anyway. Well, both the Senate and the House were up to some hijinks this week. We had, let's start with the Senate and the gun reform legislation I referred to a moment ago. On Wednesday, Republicans were able to successfully block the amendment to the gun reform legislation being considered. That amendment would have closed the so-called gun show loophole and expanded background check requirements to include all gun sales. Right now, private gun sales, which makes some 40% of firearm sales in this country, are exempted. It's a huge loophole that allows people with mental health backgrounds, people with felony convictions, all sorts of people who shouldn't be handling firearms, to get them really easily. And it's a measure that was supported by 90% of the American public. But it couldn't get the support of enough Republicans to avoid a filibuster that managed to kill the amendment. Even more shockingly, and this is a measure that probably would be supported by even more than 90% of Americans, the next day the Senate also blocked, and it was the same suspects, mostly Republicans involved, that they blocked another amendment from Patrick Leahy of Vermont that would have cracked down on straw purchases. Now, straw purchases, for those who don't know, are when somebody goes in on behalf of a gang member or convicted felon or somebody else not eligible for a legal purchase and makes the purchase on their behalf. And this is a favorite way, for example, for gang members and other criminals to get guns legally. But they, and the NRA supported this particular measure even. But nonetheless, there were so many Republicans who did not support it that it once again got blocked. This really is a case, and it happens on a number of different issues, but it's rarely so obvious, and it's rarely so extreme, the vast, vast gulf between what the American public wants and what our elected representatives actually do, or in this case, don't do. And if something like this can't pass, even in the wake of Newtown, even when it has, for all practical purposes, unanimous public support, it really makes you despair for getting anything done, even on more critical issues like climate change, where there are much larger vested economic interests opposing it.
All right. Also this week, the House passed CISPA onto the Senate.
Yeah, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, CISPA. Get used to hearing those words. The House passing by a 288-127 vote, the measure, it would basically allow the government to get any of your private information off the Internet. And, you know, can get that information from communication companies. It can get your communications. It can get your medical records. They can get your financial records. It really is an extraordinarily dangerous piece of legislation. And once again, it's being done in the name of security and to prevent terrorism. In fact, you had somebody on the floor of the House this week arguing that, you know, the bombings in Boston made it even more critical than ever to pass CISPA, as though that would have anything whatsoever to do with preventing an act like what happened in Boston this week. Or for that might have something to do with preventing the act in Texas, but those aren't the emails that they're going to be looking at. Again, the same bill with a few modifications passed the House last year. It died in the Senate not because there wasn't the votes for it, but because there was so much Republican obstruction last year in the Senate that they couldn't get to a lot of their legislative calendar. So it has a real chance of passing this year. The Obama White House has issued a veto threat. Nobody really knows whether that's a genuine threat or whether it's a negotiating ploy so that they can get measures in the bill that are more favorable to executive branch power, which has happened with some other civil liberty legislation. And so this is an issue, again, where people, where legislators really need to hear from the public. And in our case, Senators Cantwell and Murray, as this bill goes on to the Senate, need to hear from us that this is unacceptable and that they need to do everything in their power to oppose it.
All right. Next up, our single item of good news from the week.
Oh, come on. There's more good news than that. Hold out hope for folks. Yeah, we talked last week about a court ruling in California around federal sale of some BLM land for fracking purposes that really set a precedent in terms of the federal courts acknowledging that fracking does have serious environmental damages, that it needs to be treated differently than normal environmental proposals. We had another great precedent-setting court ruling this week. This was out of the state of Pennsylvania. A judge there ruled that under Pennsylvania law, corporations do not have the same rights as actual biological people. Now, this hits both on fracking, because it's the case at hand, and the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that constitutions are, in fact, people, my friend. The ruling came in a case where local media outlets had wanted to unseal a confidential settlement of a lawsuit in which a landowner was paid $175,000 after suing a fracking company over environmental damages to their land. It's a big development nationally, not just in Pennsylvania. And the reason is that companies have been using invoking their privacy rights, quote unquote, to seal settlements of lawsuits like that. And they're in Pennsylvania, where they've been doing fracking the most and for the longest period of time in this country. It really got started there in the middle of the last decade. You're starting to see a lot more of the long-term consequences of what happens when you inject a stew of toxic chemicals a number of thousand feet into the ground, where it can leach into the groundwater and streams and all the rest of that kind of stuff. So far with fracking, there's been a real problem in terms of getting access to science on the long-term effects, for the simple reason that companies have been withholding that information. They've been withholding the information on the studies that they do themselves, but they've also been trying to get these agreements sealed so that when people do sue because their property values have plummeted, they can't talk to the media or the public about what actually the damages were, and so nobody finds out. In this case, the privacy ruling also was a ruling that corporations don't have the same kind of privacy expectations around that biological people do. And so that will likely get appealed to a higher court based on the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that constitutions are, in fact, biological people. But in the meantime, we may find out some really valuable information on just what kind of impacts fracking is having on these places where it's been going on for some number of years.
All right. And briefly, update on Occupy?
Yeah, a great news dump item yesterday. While everybody was tracking the manhunt in Boston, the DA in New York City announced that no criminal charges are going to be filed against NYPD Deputy Inspector Anthony Bologna, the famous Tony Bologna. He was the guy who pepper sprayed Occupy Wall Street protesters more or less randomly in 2011, and that incident more than anything else turned Occupy Wall Street from a fringe protest into something that got a lot of media attention and then caught on around the country. And of course we saw a lot of other police violence, including here in Seattle, in the aftermath of that. Well, criminal charges had been being discussed against him for all this time. The DA finally saying that, and this again is a quote, "We cannot prove these allegations criminally beyond a reasonable doubt." Once again, who are you going to believe? The cops are your lying eyes and the video that's been all over TV and the internet for the last 2 years. And this really is a problem with criminal charges for law enforcement officers for anything, is that as under a lot of different state laws, including Washington State, as we saw with John T. Williams, as long as the officer believes themselves, and what else are they going to say, to be trying to carry out their duties to their best of ability when they kill somebody or beat somebody or whatever it is, they're not going to be charged with it. It's a free pass, and it's really a disturbing situation.
All right. New poll from Galway.
Yeah, Gallup, actually.
Gallup, sorry.
With a poll that, that's okay. Galway's in Ireland. It's a little different. Yeah, a new Gallup poll, suggesting that, Americans really do want to soak the rich. 52% of Americans, support, and this is Gallup's wording, heavy taxes on the rich to redistribute wealth. Of course, as we saw this week, you know, you can have 90% American approval and it doesn't mean Congress is going to do it. But that sounds like a radical proposition, but it's exactly what we were doing in the 1950s, which is for many conservatives their imaginary golden age of when, you know, women and blacks knew their place, et cetera, et cetera. And we had this ideal society. Well, the upper income, levels of progressive income tax were like 90% in those days. And they're much, much lower now. So, again, this is something a majority of Americans support, and it's still not likely to happen soon.
All right. On to Antarctica.
Yeah, I also didn't get a lot of attention this week, but a new study published in the magazine Natural Geoscience once again confirms that climate change is happening a lot faster and a lot more severely than previously thought. In this case, the authors were studying the acceleration of the Antarctic summer ice melt during the 20th century compared to previous centuries, and not including this century, that is the last few years, and found that the rate of the Antarctic summer melt has increased by a factor of 10 over the last 500 years, and most of that has happened in the last since the middle of the last century, in other words, since about 1950. Again, a huge amount of fresh water stored as ice in Antarctica, if it finds its way into the oceans, that's going to raise sea levels, just as the Arctic and Greenland ice melts are doing. And the rate of Antarctic ice melt found by the study is about twice as fast as was previously believed, even in a study last year that it was happening. And yet, again, after 30 years after we know that climate change is a thing, our government still isn't doing anything about it.
All right. And finally, the IMF.
Yeah. The other piece of good news, see, there was more than one this week, is a sort of man bites dog story where the head of the IMF is telling The British government, which has been one of the number of European governments that's been imposing austerity measures in recent years, the results have been so bad with the weak economy and higher unemployment and so forth that they're looking at yet more austerity, which is to say slashing social services in order to better try to balance the budget. And the head of the IMF, a woman named Christine Lagarde, told the British Chancellor, George Osborne, on Thursday, just to knock it off, that it's being counterproductive. And if you have the IMF, which has been, you know, destroying economies in the third and now the first world for decades with these sorts of austerity programs, that you're going too far and doing too much, it really tells you that the evidence is pretty overwhelming that it's not working. And it hasn't worked in all of these European countries where it's being tried, just as it's never worked in Latin America or other third world countries. And yet, still, we have a fetish on both sides of the aisle in this country with balancing the budget and cutting spending.
All right. Events.
Yeah, a number of events this week. We didn't have many the last couple weeks because they were all waiting for this week. Starting today, 11 o'clock this morning, the I Matter Earth Day Youth March is going to be happening at Victor Steinbrook Park at Virginia Western, just north of Pike's Place Market. Tomorrow at noon, there will be the Honoring Earth Awareness Walk. That will be starting at the Olympic Sculpture Park in Belltown at the north end of the downtown Seattle waterfront. Also tomorrow from 2 to 4 o'clock, Connecting a Fevered Planet, Connecting the Movement, Healing a Feeling Planet, I'm sorry, that is with author Garla Powell of Grist Magazine. That will be at the Fremont Library on 531 North 35th Street in beautiful downtown Fremont. And then also on Sunday from 4 to 5:30, this is tomorrow, a book release party for Russell Maroon Schotes. He's a former Black Panther from Philadelphia who's been in solitary for the last 30 years. That book will be celebrated and readings from it at Black Coffee Co-op, 501 East Pine in downtown Seattle. On Monday, the 22nd, as you mentioned earlier, Seattle City Council South Lake Union Committee meeting to vote on provisions for affordable housing for new South Lake Union developments. That will be at the Council Chambers of Seattle City Hall on 5th Avenue, downtown Seattle at Cherry. On Tuesday, the 23rd, 6 o'clock, In Factory Fires, a panel with Bangladeshi workers. That will be at room 200 of Savory Hall on the UW campus. On Wednesday at 11:30, as a continuation of that celebration and in honor of Worker Memorial Day, there will be a ceremony to honor workers killed or injured on the job. That at the Hub Building on the UW campus. Also on Wednesday at 8:30, the Homeless Survival Roadshow is once again going to be protesting the quarterly board meeting of the Coalition to End Homelessness in King County sometime in the 23rd century. That will be again at City Hall, 600 Fifth Avenue in downtown Seattle.
And I think they're meeting ahead of time at like 7th and I can't remember. Anyway, a half hour ahead of that.
Yeah, and we have for all of these events, we have the links on the website, so you can go and check them out at eatthestate.org. On Thursday, it just keeps coming, a good friend Jim Ekus is going to be presenting on global war and global warming. That will be at the Common Good Cafe at the University of Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday. And then next Saturday, and we're mentioning it here because it gets an early start, from 9 a.m. through 3:30 p.m., Self-Defense on the Job, Understanding Labor and Industries, a workshop on how to seek change or redress for unsafe working conditions. $10 donation will get you into that workshop with a sliding scale and work exchange possible. That's sponsored by the Organized Workers for Labor Solidarity. It'll be at the Seattle Labor Temple, First and Broad in Belltown. So a lot to keep you busy this week. If you're depressed from the last week's events, don't get depressed. Get up and get busy.
And today, I forgot there's the big forum, Western Washington Fellowship of Reconciliation is doing something at a local church. So I need to get that one on. It's starting now.
Okay. Well, I don't know that. I usually get their mailing, so I don't know what that one is, but WWFOR.org is their website. So you can go and check that out.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And once again this week with Maria gone, we could post all of the notes and links from the stories you heard even before we come on the air. So go and check them out. They're waiting there for you. All of the events, you can find out more information or any of the stories we covered in the last half hour.